So today we heard in the gospel something that's really well known, but especially that phrase of render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, or give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. But even so, I suggest you might want to have it open in front of you, because I'm going to bring out its meaning for today. And I think it's often been used to present a picture of the relationship between God's kingdom and the world that doesn't quite work, so I'm going to look at this a bit further. In Matthew, it's part of the events of the last week in Jerusalem that Jesus spends there. He describes, Matthew describes three symbolic actions that Jesus does: coming to Jerusalem on a donkey, overturning the tables in the temple, and then cursing the fig tree. And then it's followed by three parables. And we've had those for the last 3 weeks. And now we have three hostile questions. And this is the first of these, but Matthew seems to like to bring out things in threes, so perhaps 3 points make it memorable. So this is the first hostile question, and it's brought by the disciples of the Pharisees and the Herodians, who team up to tackle Jesus. Matthew always specifies who's present in these conversations, these encounters that Jesus has with people. This emphasizes that the opposition to Jesus comes from lots of different sources. There are two very different parties who've joined together to try and catch out Jesus. The Pharisees are lay people who have a deep concern for religious purity, for following God carefully. And they'd not normally have anything to do with the Herodians, because they are effectively those who compromise with the Roman rule. They're members of the political elite who are trying to make the best out of being occupied, cooperating with the puppet kings that Rome has put in place to rule Judea from a distance. Perhaps the Pharisees only sent their disciples on this mission to limit their own contact with these whom they considered beyond the pale. It also seems to be a case of the enemy of my enemy is sometimes my friend. So the purists and the compromisers come to Jesus with a question that they have opposite interests in, but they know that he'll be damned one way or the other if he answers the question at all. The Pharisees would say that everything should be given to God, and that giving something to Caesar prevents them from doing that. And that was actually a common enough understanding of the people of that day, to the extent that there were a couple of Jewish revolts that were recorded by historians of the time about that very point. They were put down very firmly with many crucifixions by the Romans to ensure that everyone knew they really had to pay that tax. Meanwhile, the Herodians would be keen to ensure that Jesus was not advocating another tax rebellion. So the Pharisees were plotting to entrap Jesus. The word used here means entangle. They wanted to entrap him in what he says, in his own words. And yet they begin by flattering him with a description that he always tells the truth. That is, they want him to be proved a hypocrite, someone who does or says things differently at different times, or doesn't do what they actually say they will do. And that's the very thing he begins by calling them. On his reply. Now, the flattering speech that they begin with seems very sort of well rehearsed, carefully prepared. And yet, what they actually say is true, though they may not have thought of it as such. The first phrase is in our translation, "You are sincere." It's actually, "You are true." Not very far from Jesus' own claim. "I am the truth." And they say he teaches the way of God in accordance with the truth. He doesn't say one thing in one situation and one thing in another. The next phrase of flattery in our translation, show deference to no one, or sometimes said you don't care about anyone's opinion or you aren't swayed by others. It's translating that the simple idiom of no one is of concern to you. It's clearly not in the sense of being unconcerned about the welfare of others, but it's about being not concerned to impress or flatter them. Precisely the thing that his opponents are actually trying to do with him. And then the final flattery might be taken as, you're not swayed by appearances. Since the phrase is simply, you do not look on a person's face. This idea has deep roots in the Old Testament. When Samuel is discerning who will be king of Israel, God instructs him not to be impressed by outward appearances. It says in Samuel 16, the Lord does not look at the things human beings look at. People look at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. This refers to being impartial, not making a judgment on rank or outward appearance or showing favoritism. And it's a central aspect of God's character, God's nature, that he does not show favoritism, that he is impartial. The deceitful flatterers are ironically attributing this key characteristic of God to Jesus. And they make that the basis of asking him for a judgment on the emperor's tax. So Jesus' opponents have a background assumption that one cannot both be giving to Caesar and giving to God. You cannot do one without refusing to do the other. So he's supposedly caught in a bind here. And if he supports the paying of the tax, then he will be seen to be compromising his devotion to God, and he'll lose the support of those who long for political freedom, which we can see expressed earlier in Luke, for example, both in spiritual and theological terms, in the hope of the coming Messiah, Luke chapter 1, to rescue us from the hand of our enemies and to enable us to serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. Now that's the whole thing of being free from any occupation by enemies. But if he supports withholding of the tax here at the center of power in Jerusalem, he will look like a seditious rebel and appear to make his claim as a rival leader to the power of Rome. And that's actually the kind of claim that he is unjustly convicted upon. So Jesus' response to this question both exposes the cunning and the hypocrisy of his opponents, and it undermines the theological assumption of the dilemma that they have presented him with. Jesus is fully aware of their malice on such an important issue. They are more interested in scoring political and theological points than really resolving that question. And he accuses them of testing or tempting him. And he uses the term perazo, which describes the activity of Satan in the wilderness at the start of his mission. So that testing never really stopped, even if the players had changed. And if I could have the first image of the PowerPoint. This is he then highlights their hypocrisy. This is the denarius. It was a comparatively large value coin, being worth a day's wages for a worker, as we've heard in the parables previously. But the actual coin didn't have to be used for payment. A denarius in the time of the Emperor Tiberius would have the image of the emperor, which was in itself a serious offence to observant Jews. You're not supposed to have the image of a person exalted in such a way. But also it has the inscription with sort of abbreviations. Tiberius Caesar, Divi Augusti Filius Augustus, which means Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. So that was on one side, and on the other side was an abbreviation of Pontifex Maximus, which means high priest. So he's thus proclaimed not only to be the son of the divine Augustus, but also a high priest. And these two titles together could hardly be more calculated to offend that Jewish piety. And yet Jesus' opponents, the disciples, the Pharisees, have one in their pocket and are carrying it around. Those who appear most concerned about ritual purity and political independence are carrying with them the very signs of spiritual compromise and political collusion. Much is often made of the fact that the coin has the image, the icon of the emperor on it, and that all human beings are made in the image of God. So there's an analogy between handing over the coin in payment of the tax and the handing over of ourselves in obedience to the call of God. But in fact, in this conversation, that parallel is not really drawn on or emphasized at all. That's not the primary issue. More important is Jesus' emphasis, which we don't see so well in the, say, traditional translation of render unto Caesar, or even in our translation today, give to the emperor. The actual emphasis is on paying back, giving back. If the coin has the emperor's head on it, then there's a sense in which paying the tax is indeed giving back what belongs to the emperor. And there's a pointer here to that basic principle of fair taxation, that tax covers the costs of what governments spend for the benefit of the population at large. A better translation would be, give back to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. What's more important here is the whole way in which Jesus is redrawing the theological relationship between political power and the action of God's kingdom. The Pharisees, along with Jewish groups, see the spiritual and political inseparably entwined. So if I could have the first picture of circles. So here we have, say, the blue being the kingdom of God, and the comes up rather sort of brown, doesn't it? It's pink on my original, being political power, the political sphere. And the Pharisees, along with other Jewish groups, see these inseparably entwined, they're overlapping, so that actually God's kingdom cannot be realized without the accompanying political regime change. So the spheres of God's action and political reality mostly overlap, and they're rival regimes making competing claims for loyalty. But the Pharisees and most of the Jews of those times thought that these spheres needed to be totally overlapping for God's kingdom to come. That God's kingdom was to be a political sphere in itself. And all through Jesus' ministry, you see that, people expressing that. And actually, that's the way that Islam still views political power today. Yet this is something that Jesus rejected from the very beginning of his ministry. You know, despite the political implications of his proclamation of the kingdom of God, he has refused to pursue a political path to its realization. And he's specifically rejected the political ambitions of those who would make him king, For example, in the feeding of the 5,000, they immediately wanted to make him king, and he said no, and he went away. The kingdom of God has political implications, but these can never be achieved by merely political means. This is not just a conviction of Jesus. The whole of the history of the Old Testament testifies to its reality. It's a change of heart, not merely a change of regime, that the people need. So we go on to the second view that's often taken of this passage. You know, much of the interpretation of Jesus' saying here has separated these two spheres of the authority of God and the authority of the emperor, or the successive powers that have taken his place. We render unto Caesar what is his due, for example, in paying taxes, and quite separately, we render unto God what is his due, for example, in pious devotion and church attendance. In this reading, what God requires of us and what Caesar requires of us are quite separate, so that our political and economic and social lives are separate from our religious lives. And this has been a distinctive approach of post-Enlightenment modernity in our society, where the religious becomes an interest or a hobby, or even a set of important motivating personal convictions. The values that you live by, supposedly. But it can never make claims over the political realm. It's a private rather than a public truth. And that's basically what New Zealand society thinks now, including many Christians. And apart from a few that are really involved in totally Christian parties, who tend to think rather like the Pharisees of first century Judea, that we should have a totally Christian government. That's going back to their point of view. But this complete separation, it's not what Jesus was getting at either. Jesus clearly believes that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, like Psalm 24 says. Whatever power the emperor or any other ruler has, they have it only because it's been delegated to them by God, as Jesus explicitly says to Pilate during the trial described in the fourth gospel. It says, he actually says to Pilate, you would have no power over me unless it had been given to you from above. The answer to the questions, what should we pay back to Caesar and to God, is answered by asking another pair of questions. What rightly belongs to Caesar and what rightly belongs to God? And so we go to the third diagram of circles. Yeah, the sphere of influence and power of Caesar doesn't sit so much as a complete system as a rival to the power of God, and nor is it an alternative sphere of activity, an authority separate from the concerns of the kingdom. Instead, it rightly sits within the concerns of God and his authority. This means there's no one political system or ideology which has a monopoly on kingdom realities. And neither is any regime free from scrutiny, the scrutiny of God. So we should treat political and economic systems with due respect, as Paul says in Romans 13, acknowledging the source of all true authority, and recognizing the purposes of good government under the authority of God. The purposes to promote good and restrain evil, for example. But we also need to be alert to the moments in all political systems where Caesar claims more power than is his due, or seeks to displace the kingdom and take the role of God in the offer that he makes or in the loyalty he demands. Whilst we render to Caesar what is his legitimate due, that must also sit an accountability to our higher duty to render to God what is his due. So we should pay taxes, but we should also work for a fairer tax system in accord with the values of the kingdom of God, so that everyone, as they pay their taxes, can do so with a clear conscience. And we obey and serve as well as we can the authorities over us, knowing that all authority comes from above. As we are accountable to the authorities over us, they are accountable to God rather than to us. And we too are accountable to God in all of life, including our life in the world around us, not just our inner or spiritual life. And it's this theological understanding of political power which will enable us as followers of Jesus to seek first the kingdom of God, without needing to see that expressed in a specific political state and a geographical territory. And this means that we are able to bring that dynamic of the kingdom to every tribe, language, people, and nation, and to challenge every culture from within too, including our New Zealand culture, as we live fully involved in this country. So what have we personally regarded as outside of the kingdom of God in our own lives? What spheres of life do we tend to not consider as relevant to our life as Jesus followers? Where do we think that Jesus has no say, perhaps? Politics is still commonly in this place. Also sport. Our leisure activities and the decisions around family, work, holidays, they all can be pushed perhaps outside of the influence of Jesus. Where we are in the world, when we're faced with being like those around us or being followers of Jesus. This is quite challenging, personally, and so perhaps we need to take a moment or two to think about the decisions we've made recently in each area of our lives. Is there anything we need to consider again? If we're truly to submit that area of our life under the authority and reign of Jesus. Now, how do we shop? How do we celebrate family occasions? They're all part of being in life. They're not supposed to be outside of God's authority. They're supposed to be under. And there's lots of ways we can do that under the kingdom of God.